This is the New Joy of Gaming podcast. Welcome to the Joy of Gaming podcast. I'm Rich Lepore.
I'm Brandon Brino.
And today we are continuing our look at the most definitive games of every console generation. And today we're turning our gaze to the Nintendo 64. I gotta say, Brandon, not my favorite console, man. Mm-hmm. not my favorite console. And it starts with the controller, can I just say?
Okay.
I don't know. Just real quick, did you love N64 overall? There's some bangers.
Let's talk. Let's get to our histories. I think it'll become clear.
Okay.
What I think.
Okay.
Of it. Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Because it's not a simple just blah.
Yeah.
I get it. That makes total sense. Okay. So why don't I, before we get to that, tell you a little bit about the evolution of this segment. So so far we've done the NES definitive games and we've done the SNES definitive games. NES, we got a pretty clean list pretty quickly. SNES, there's a lot of different things where we were kind of hit some road bumps and figuring out. And ultimately, we decided that the format needed to be updated. And so previously, we would each bring our own lists from the very beginning of the episode, and then we'd blend them in sort of a somewhat clunky process, to be honest, together into one definitive list throughout the podcast. Now we're taking that portion of things offline beforehand. And so now I have presented my list of my favorite 10 games, or excuse me, not favorite, definitive games, things that I would put up as the top 10 most definitive games for the system. I've given that list to Brandon in advance. Brandon has his own top 10 list, and he has done all of the math and knows what our official top 10 definitive games are. I, however, do not yet know.
Mm-hmm.
So we are going to present them to you at the same time that I'm hearing them, so I'll be reacting, and then we'll just be listing through the 10 games, and then each of us talking about that game and what we think of it, why we think it's significant, why we think it belongs on the list. And then after we're done with our definitive list, then we're going to move on to some honorable mentions. And this is where some of the games that are maybe not the top 10 games that you would recommend somebody play if you wanted them to know what that console was all about, but maybe number 17 on the list or number 35 on the list. But to you, really, really significant. You either had experiences with it, it was impactful to you, etc. So hopefully you get a 1-2 punch here. Number one, you get the list. If you want to come here and say, what are the most definitive games? Two people that lived through this era who've played a whole lot of video games up to this point's opinion on what are the definitive games. And me and Brandon take this very seriously. Like, we don't mess around. We're really thinking about how to give the best possible recommendations here, credibly, right? And with the experience of what we've played, what we've read, all kinds of stuff over the years. And then in the second portion, you get to hear more of the personal stories and the impact that some of these games have had on us, why we love them, etc. So hopefully between all of that, we will do what I think the purpose of this segment has always been from the beginning, is to celebrate these consoles, celebrate these console generations, and give people a real sense of what it feels like to play them now and what it felt like to play them then.
Yep.
Anything to add?
Yeah, no, I'll just say about the honorable mentions section. So previously, the way we had done that is that, you know, whatever sort of did not make the top 10 list but was on our list would be like honorable mentions. And then we would have like other things like, hey, these are also games I liked or that I thought were good. So I think what we've done here is we've kind of streamlined that segment in a way, in the sense that we both come with like 3 to 5 games that we want to specifically focus on the honorable mentions. And those could be either, like what Rich said, they were just games that meant something personal to us. Or they could just be games that, hey, this just missed the list. I think it's worthy of a top 10. It just happened to just missed it. So it's kind of like a balance of those two things, you know, like things we personally really loved and have great memories with, or games that we feel like were worthy of the list and just maybe just missed it. But I also think it'll be good because now we can dive a little bit deeper into those honorable mentions where we've kind of selected just a few of them.
It's been a burn-off list before. It's like for one of the other consoles, it's been like, here are 15 games. Let me just rattle them off. Maybe I'll talk a little bit in depth about a couple of them. And either if you talk a lot about them, you get a stupid long episode, or you don't talk enough about them. This way, we get to really focus in on the real hits. And I think if you think about what you'll end up with out of this, let's say we each pick 3 HMs, honorable mentions. Well, you've got now at the end a list of 10 games that you just have to play, like definitively. Again, a mix between my opinion, Brandon's opinion, and then we both very specifically think about, like, what are other people's top 10 lists? What have we read about different games? What it seems to be the consensus in the industry? What are the games that have come since the these games that have been influenced by them? What has been the influence or the reach? How do these games reach back from their original era, reach forward into our current era, and how have they influenced everything that came after? So really taking all of that and putting it together into that top 10. But then also, you've got another six games that are wild cards, right? They may be number 11 on the list, as one of my honorable mentions would have been our number 11, or they may be number 87, you know what I mean? But that'll be cool. So I think between the two, you'll get a real good smattering of what N64 is all about.
Yep.
So I think that means it's time for histories. I'm going to let you go first. What's your history with the N64, Brandon Brino?
So the N64 for me was probably like I was at the age where this was like the first console that I had where I was like more aware of like what was coming out and when and like
magazines.
So I had more access to that. Like I was at that age where I could like find all that stuff and also just had the ability to like get more games, you know, like maybe I had some money of my own, like so like,
or at least autonomy over that money. Before it was like maybe you don't know what's under the tree or whatever. Now it's I have $60 from lawn mowing or my parents gave me an allowance. I've saved it. Now I can buy whatever.
Exactly. So it was like there was like more of a way for me to like sort of dictate what games I was getting when I was getting them more so than, you know, the previous console generation.
Did that mean more anticipation as well?
Exactly, yeah. So like knowing what was coming out, when it was coming out, and like having more autonomy of like when I could get a game, you know, sort of led to all those things. So for those reasons, like the N64 like holds like a very special place in my sort of gaming history because like I said, it was kind of like that first system that was like really mine. Like I my mom drove me to Costco and like I paid for half and she paid for half, you know what I mean?
Yep.
It was like, you know, like that was the time to get it. And so, and I didn't have a PlayStation 1 at the time. I had this. So this is where I was, you know, gaming, you know, during that 64-bit era, 32-bit era. But so while I don't like think like the consoles age like super gracefully, just because it was like the beginning era of like 3D, right? So like a lot of things just don't necessarily age well. I think there are like a, you know, there's like a handful of games that are like still like the greatest of the great are still must play and all that and like hold up well. But it's a weird time because like I don't want to go back to a lot of the games from the N64.
It is.
But
it
I
is
do
like
have
that.
Like some of the most nostalgia for any period of video game history.
And
you know
that,
what I mean?
And the other thing about it too that's interesting is a lot of, like I was saying before about these games reaching forward into history, you know, think about like Ocarina of Time or Super Mario 64. These are blueprints for a whole genre of video games.
Yeah.
And I'd rather play those games. You know what I mean? The games that this was the blueprint for. But you have to, I think it's important for anybody who's like a serious gamer, obviously don't do it if it's not fun, but if you find it fun to like look at the history of these things and go back and play that history and then see how it's influenced what you play today, there's a lot of enjoyment in just that. So I think that's the position when we think about like, does it hold up today? I think in some ways we're going to have to look at that, at least with the N64, as in like, yeah, it holds up today in terms of it's still fun to play. Probably wouldn't be the first or the 10th thing I would play, but it's certainly something that I need to play at least once to understand the impact that it's had and that it's still worth doing today. You know? Well, I'll go ahead and I'll give you my history. So I don't remember this is when things started to blend a little bit to me. And this is also when I was at this point in my life, I was busy with a lot of other things. So video games weren't as forefronted as they were before or as they were after in some ways. But I had an N64, and I actually did a lot more social gaming with the N64 than maybe any other era, which is maybe weird. But I remember this time as a time when like everybody was talking about GoldenEye when that came out. For me, like there were certain sports games that everybody was playing and I was playing and we loved. I played Killer Instinct Gold, like unbelievably. We had our band had a practice space and we played that game. So there are all of these things that are like kind of built into my life that were experiential from that game. There's more that I don't want to just spoil everything and rattle off the list, but there's a lot of these different games that seeped into other areas of my life and became like an aspect of my life. And they're indelibly attached to those experiences. But I don't, even when those games were out, like people loved some of these games more than I ever did. And I think the biggest problem that I ever had was I never liked the 3D stick on the controller. I didn't like it back then. Some people were like, oh yeah, it doesn't hold up. I hated it when it was new. I just didn't like it. I thought it, I didn't like that it was in the center like it was. I didn't like the way it felt to use it. It was just weird. And I think maybe part of that comes from I had some PC gaming experience from the like Apple IIc era of video games. And I remember having like a joystick that was like a bigger version of that little thing. And it just like, I don't know, something about that joystick sucking. And then like it forever tainted my experience with the N64 controller. I don't know. There were a lot of reasons why it just, I bounced off of it. But there were lots of games that I played on it also that I had amazing experiences with. And I just enjoyed them in spite of some of the inherent limitations that that console had. When we start to go into the history here in a minute, it was a very odd decision that Nintendo made, this console. They made a lot of odd decisions, and a lot of those, you know, turned out to be very prescient and again, influenced everything that was to come. And a lot of them were really big deal killers, you know, that really hurt this console, you know, both at the time and its longevity to this day. So it's an oddball. It really is. But yet it holds some of the most revered games of all time within its library, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
Well, I guess, do you want to jump into history, man?
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's do history, and then we'll take a quick break after that, and then we'll dive into our list. So, all right, history. Bring us through it, man.
Okay, so the N64, or Nintendo 64, was released in Japan on June 23rd, 1996, and then it was released in North America on September 26, 1996, and then in Europe and Australia, March 1st, 1997. And then it was officially discontinued in 2002. It sold 32.93 million units worldwide, making it the 17th best-selling video game console of all time. And this can kind of continue the trend, as we said, going from NES, SNES to Nintendo 64. You know, the overall sales were declining for Nintendo. Now, the major reason it happened for the SNES was the console wars were huge at that time. So there was a huge competition between Sega's marketing and you know, just the mind share of video games at that point. Here, the competition becomes even greater, partly because of one of the biggest blunders I feel like in history, which yep. is Nintendo kind of creating one of their biggest enemies or competitors. Famously, they were working on a disc space add-on for the Nintendo Super Nintendo, and they were working with Sony on that. They ended up kind of spurning them, you know, like some point during this process, and switching over to a partnership with Philips, and that's what led to their you know partnership with Philips. Why the Philips CDI had like Mario and Zelda games on it and all that. But Sony didn't just sit there and, you know, cry in the corner. They said, okay, we'll do it ourselves. And they joined the video game space with the PlayStation, one of the best-selling consoles of all time, and went on to launch, you know, one of the biggest brands, right, in gaming and just in just
a brand that has won multiple gaming generations.
Yes.
Period.
One of the interesting things about the N64 is that it was technically more powerful than some of its competitors primarily being the PlayStation 1 and the Sega Saturn. Sega Saturn was pretty much a failure in North America. You know, it was way more popular in Japan. So it was really going toe-to-toe with PlayStation versus N64. I mean, that probably like all your friends only had those two things. I know mine did. One of the big differences here was, although the N64 was technically more powerful, the reason it was called the Nintendo 64 is because it had a 64-bit CPU. The PlayStation 1 was a 32-bit system. Remember the bit wars? Like everything was about bits.
Yep.
8-bit, 16-bit. Now we're at 64-bit. Pretty much there's tons of Nintendo 64 games that have the number 64 in the title.
Yep.
Just going with this whole like marketing umbrella scheme, you know, of 64. But the thing was, they stuck with cartridge-based games.
And I'm shaking my head,
and
man.
While cartridges have advantages in the sense that there's very little to no load times, the size of those cartridges essentially seriously limit what you could do. So very often you would see like certain things developers wanted to do with audio and music or pre-rendered FMV cutscenes. They just simply could not use the Nintendo 64 to do what they envisioned to do, whereas you had Sony PlayStation deciding to go with CD-ROM base as well as the Sega Saturn. And it was possible to do those things because you could have multiple discs. The discs just had more memory just in general versus the cartridges.
And maybe the biggest distinction of all, they're incredibly cheap.
And obviously very cheap to manufacture.
So, I mean, the thing about N64 cartridges is they were extremely expensive. Cartridges were always expensive, and the larger they were, the more expensive they got. And this is a problem that continued on through many generations of cartridge-based Nintendo systems. But this really goes back to Nintendo being mavericks of the industry, and it's been like their biggest success and their biggest failure, their biggest Achilles heel, because they were just like, no, load times are not customer friendly. They're not gamer friendly. We make fun friendly, easily accessible games for families and for kids, and no kids want to deal with wait times. No kids want to deal with loading. That's not a good experience. And they just were flat out wrong. You know, they were wrong because, yeah, it's not a great experience. And it's a problem that has persisted with disc-based systems really up until the modern day. It wasn't until the PS5 and the Xbox Series X, and I guess the S, that they have SSDs, and they finally have cracked this load time problem. And you load to the SSD, and it's almost instantaneous in terms of load times. I mean, Resident Evil 4 Remake is, like, instant, right? Nearly. But Nintendo was just not willing to make that sacrifice, so instead they made about 1,000 other sacrifices. In the sense that, think about, you know, what made PlayStation 1 so amazing, or one of the games that, like, really showed everybody that gaming was changing, and that was the Final Fantasy VII, you know? Mm-hmm. And that is a game that it was incredibly long. It had full motion video. It had incredible cutscenes.
Orchestrated music, right. And amazing music on it, no compression or very little.
Right, all kinds of stuff you just straight up just couldn't do on the N64. And the N64 did cool stuff, and it started trends, and it created genres. But it was very hamstrung by this cartridge decision. And it also meant, because the rest of the industry had gone another direction, that third parties that wanted to try new things or had different ambitions couldn't take those games over. Like, if there were only a couple that ever got ported to NCC, like Doom, for example, mm-hmm. and it sucked, or, you know, like Resident Evil, and, you know,
like you said, like Square pretty much abandoned Nintendo.
Couldn't
at this
do what
point.
They wanted to do,
but that they, you know, they their internal vision did not align with Nintendo's, right? And this, you know, Final Fantasy and other games like had historically always been on Nintendo, and now, you know, now they weren't. Capcom and Konami largely left. I mean, there are some exceptions, like Resident Evil 2 somehow got an insane, like, how did they even do it? Like, they ported Resident Evil 2, they ported Mega Man Legends. Konami had a couple of releases on, you know, but most of that stuff, like, was on PlayStation. So, and just to give you an idea of the size disparity, CDs could hold around 700 megabytes. The largest game cartridges ever produced for the N64 held 64 megabytes.
Yeah.
Max.
So less than a tenth.
Yeah.
and that's one CD.
Right.
A lot of games had 3 or 4 CDs. So, yeah. I mean, you can...
Especially like the RPGs and all that, yeah.
Which was just amazing. And that's why, even though the N64 had the games that, like, you know, Ocarina that started, you know, 3D action-adventure game genre, and, you know, the very first really, like, amazing archetype for what a 3D platformer could look like with Mario 64, but it didn't feel like the future back then. If PlayStation felt like the future, N64 felt like a little bit archaic, a little bit in the past. And even though time has borne out that it was incredibly revolutionary what they were doing with it, at the time it felt in the past. Because if you think about it, like, even though it's 64-bit, and even though you're playing these amazingly designed games, it still looked cartoony. Whereas you look at, and gamey, whereas you look at PlayStation, it looks like adult content. It looks like this is for adults who watch movies and, like, are living in the real world and want their video games to mimic that real world and to be facsimiles of what the real world looks like. Digitized actors, voices, video, grittiness, which also, just by Nintendo's nature, they didn't want to go those directions, right. And the console wouldn't really allow it anyway. Eventually, it seems like they relented a little with Doom and things like that, and Resident Evil, whatever, and things. But generally speaking, one felt like an adult console and one felt like a kiddie system. True. You know? So.
Yeah, like and remember, like a lot of people, like I had a lot of friends that would use their PlayStation 1 to like play music CDs and things like that.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? So like,
and then the PS2 was the most successful DVD player ever sold.
Yeah. So just what I was saying, like, you know, like the N64 like kind of felt like you said like a kid's toy, whereas the PlayStation 1 sort of felt like this multimedia device.
Yeah,
right?
Well,
where,
said.
You know, where you play music and all that sort of stuff. But I mean, there. I think I don't want to lessen it too much. I think when people did pop on Mario 64 for the first time, I mean, minds were blown.
Oh,
I mean,
sure.
For sure. Same thing with Ocarina of Time, which we'll get to when we, you know, inevitably get to those games. But, you know, the leap from 16-bit to 3D was huge. I mean, it can't be understated.
They were trying to play with it, like, you know, with, like, Mode 7 and games like Star Fox
and
on
like
SNES.
Donkey Kong Country, you know, like having those sort of like...
They were trying to... Yeah. They were like beating up against the edges of what the SNES could do in 16-bit. So they were always... They had ambitions there, and then this console let them go there. They were just so tied to those ambitions and their clear vision that they just weren't able to maybe expand beyond it. But again, that clarity of vision is the thing Nintendo is known for, and in cycles, they become the victors because of it. So, you know, yeah, the Wii U was a huge flop, but without the Wii U, there's no Switch. You know what I mean? Or maybe there is, but it would have been a whole different progression. And so it's important to remember those kind of things. So, you know, eventually the GameCube came out after the N64, and, you know, they that was like a half step into CDs. They were like, no.
Proprietary CDs, right?
Proprietary CDs. But but anyway, their clarity of vision is what I want to call out here and say that, like, even though it hamstrung them in some ways, it's also the thing that makes Nintendo Nintendo, and to this day is the thing people love the most about them, is that they follow the beat of their own drum, and more often than not, that means that they're revolutionizing the industry.
Yep, and we'll get into some examples of that real quick here because I want to transition to that. But first, I want to just say the code name for the N64 was Project Reality, and the original name was the Ultra 64. Remember there was
About Dolphin? Where was that?
That's GameCube.
Oh,
you're getting ahead of yourself. But
okay,
yeah. But remember there was that Nintendo Power issue where it had like Ultra 64. We were all like, oh, the Ultra 64.
Oh, I remember that.
Then it obviously didn't stick with that name. But going from Super to Ultra, I guess, is their idea. So let's get into some of the and by the way, one of the things was it retailed pretty cheaply. $199 was the retail price. I can vividly remember like seeing the ticket price on this.
I think
for
it
that.
Came with one controller though.
One controller, yeah.
As opposed to I think two with PlayStation, if I'm not mistaken.
I'm not sure about
Maybe
that.
Maybe not.
Yeah.
Maybe not. Maybe I'm wrong about that. But were you about to go to peripherals?
Yeah, let's do that. Yeah. So let's start with the controller. First thing to note is that the one thing Nintendo 64 did do great was that party living room experience, co-op experience, right? Four controller ports right out of the box. It was tons of party games and multiplayer games. I mean, that's what I remember most about this console. Yeah. It was a console that brought people together.
I was just going to say that. Remember I said, like, this is the kind of, so many experiences I had on it were with other people. And I've you know, since evolved into a very, pretty much of a lone gamer in that sense. I play online and stuff, but generally speaking, I play a lot of solo experiences. But back then, it's like, you had to, man. That's how this was designed. So many of the big games were designed around multiple people playing. You didn't want to play against the computer. You wanted to play against people.
So let's start with the controller. You don't like it. I think it's a very wacky design. Like no one ever held it with two hands, you know, the way that you could, like, because it had the three sort of handles. It was always the, you know, the one hand was on the center with the Z and the analog stick, while the other was for the face buttons.
Yep.
And like the D-pad was almost never used, but you could hold it D-pad wise.
And I did whenever I could, because I was that much of, I hated that Z and that stick that much that I tried to, like, whenever I could play an action game, you know, with, and there was a side scroller for the system, like Sub-Zero Mythologies. I think that was 64, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Or if there was a like a fighting game, you know, like a Mortal Kombat or something, I'd play it with that. Or if, you know, just whenever they would let me, I would hold it that way. And I actually like the way it feels held that way. But when you have to hold it like, where essentially that's the thing that's so wacky about it, is almost every game you have to hold it in an unnatural way. Like,
yeah,
why
for
make
the
a,
time, yeah.
Why make a controller that's like that? Why not put the D-pad in the middle? You know what I mean? Because that's barely used. Put the stick on the left. You know, they just, I don't know. They just didn't. But I anyway, sorry. I mean, it,
yeah. So one of the things, like you said, Nintendo being, you know, maybe not pressing enough versus like being very forward thinking is this is where Rumble was essentially invented, right? The Rumble, the N64 Rumble Pack, which would slot right into your controller. That was, I mean, that's something that has become a mainstay of gaming ever
Absolutely.
Since.
Absolutely.
I remember it came with Star Fox 64. You could get the Rumble Pack. And, you know, it enhanced a lot of games. You know, like Zelda had that whole feature where it was like it would tell you where hints were and things like that. So, yeah. And then the other thing that cartridges did was most games you would save directly to the cartridge like you had previously done, you know, whereas memory cards were needed for disk-based systems. So that was one thing that the N64 had, right? Like the need for not necessarily needing memory cards. However, there were some games that required it, and they would slot into your Rumble Pack slot on your... So that was another problem, is that since Rumble wasn't built in, sometimes you would have to forego it if you wanted save features for certain games. But I will say most games did not require the memory pack for the N64.
And then I believe there was another thing that slotted in as well. Oh, no. It was on the console.
You're talking about the expansion pack.
The memory unit, yeah.
So this is the game that... this is the thing that actually came with Donkey Kong 64 in the box, because they could not make the game work without it, right? Like there was some sort of thing.
I think it's RAM.
Right. And they just couldn't figure out how to do it. So they were just like, all right, just give them extra memory. Right. Yeah. So like
it packed
in the front of the system, there's a little door that you can do, and there's like a little dummy jumper pack in there. And then you could put this red thing in called the expansion pack, which would expand the memory of the system. And like some of the classic games that did require that were Majora's Mask and Donkey Kong 64.
Two big ones. Two really big games, especially Majora's. I mean, it's just it's interesting, man. That's an interesting decision. I mean, imagine like a little thing you stick in your console to like juice it up. Like it's just
but
weird.
It's funny to like even like the fact that like they could solve the problem that way. You know what
I know,
mean? Like
because normally speaking, like for example, PlayStation 5, great case in point. I actually just did this, by the way. I didn't mention that earlier, but I just did a memory expansion on my PS5 where I put in a terabyte SSD. And I waited a while till it got like real standardized and everybody's kind of doing it and everybody knows how it works. But anyway, they had to design the system from the very beginning to be like, it's expandable and here's how you can expand it. And it's designed such that SSD, and I don't understand computer architecture, but that SSD has slotted in right in the same area as where the, I would assume, as where the SSD and the memory is. So that like it's designed so that it literally is just a chip that chips in like a computer. Same thing with the Series X. They had to build it in from the very beginning. There's a place, they make a proprietary one, but there's a place you can slot in an extra memory card. And it's had to be designed from the very beginning that the architecture worked that way. That Nintendo could just have an expansion port that would that seamlessly just give it more RAM? Like, what?
Yeah, and like I would presume
I think it's RAM.
You had to open the systems to do those things you were talking about, right?
Oh, yeah.
Right here, it's just right on the front. So my assumption is that like that jumper pack slot, like, was for another purpose, you know, and they were able to repurpose it. You know what I'm saying? Like I don't know if they necessarily were thinking, hey, one day we might have to add more RAM. You know what I mean? Yeah, it increased the system RAM from 4 megabytes to 8 megabytes.
I was just looking it
up,
yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, so I wonder if they, like, it was like an elegant engineering solution to what they already had. But Nintendo has had, like, all sorts of, like, ports on, like, the GameCube, the fact that you could use all those ports to put the Game Boy Player on it, you know what I'm saying? Like, so that they weren't a stranger to, and systems back then weren't a stranger to like having other ports where you could do other things, like the PS2 and the hard drive and the modem and all
that,
right? So
it says also that some games will allow players to choose, I didn't know this at the time, choose a high resolution option, increasing the screen resolution from 320 by 240 to as much as 640 by 480, so double, creating crisp high definition graphics. It utilizes Nintendo 64's capability for 32-bit 16.7 million color display with 256 levels of transparency. Wow. So, I mean, the system was a marvel of technology. It just wasn't maybe quite the right tech at the right time.
Yep. And then one other thing I want to mention is the Nintendo 64 disk drive, or 64DD, which only came out in Japan, but it utilized magnetic floppy disks. And there, so it would be like a, it would be an add-on that went on the bottom of the system, and then
it looked,
Japan,
like a, looked like a big sandwich. Or
yeah,
whatever.
In Japan, you know, they had actually disk drive games that would you could actually plug into that and play with the NRC4. I remember that famous game that Doshin the Giant or whatever it was that we would always get references to in like weird games like WarioWare or like Smash Bros. And be like, what is that? Well, that was a disk drive game that, you know, only came out in Japan. So it kind of is like the Satellaview with the Super Nintendo, but you know, now there was the disk drive unit for the 64. Kind of interesting, but we never got it over here in North America. Anything else you wanted to say?
Is there any other? Were there any other like control? I don't even remember. I don't think this was an era where third-party controllers were big.
I mean, they had them.
They had them, but they were just the same thing.
Versions,
but
yeah,
it wasn't like back when. Yeah, it really was. Maybe it's because of how weird that controller is, or something. But it really was just like everybody used the standard controller, or a like you said, a shitty version of it.
Yep.
I'm trying to think if there's anything else.
They did have a ton of color variants for the systems and the controllers.
And there was that cool green transparent look that you could get.
Transparent ones.
Was there nothing else you could... No, I guess that's all you stick in the port. Yeah, there's nothing really else. Do you remember any specific games that use the memory? Not the RAM, but the...
I know a lot of some third-party games used it. I don't think like any first-party or like... I don't think any really major titles used it. I just remember occasionally, like I know Doom 64 used it. I had a couple other games that would use it, like NFL Blitz, where you could like save your game and
maybe it had to do with the idea of like saving more than just where you are in the game.
Yeah,
but rather
and,
like
and
your
you could
stats
take it to other houses and like your friend's house or something.
Oh yeah, I think you could probably interesting.
But I would say like it was the majority of the games on the N64 did not require it. So
got it. Well, this is one more little quick tidbit about you. So you were a Genesis kid. But right. You were an N64 kid.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
Is it?
I guess not, because there's no Sega system for you to move to, was there?
Well, the Saturn.
Yeah, but...
Then I wouldn't even have been here, Rich. I would have gave up on video games long ago.
Okay, all right. No, but... I mean, the Saturn, like, who was... I mean,
I don't think I knew one person that owned the Saturn, like, in that, like, during that time.
Yeah, I don't think... And I was in an environment where that could have happened. Like, I was around people who were just like, check out my Atari Lynx, you know, and shit. But, like, nobody had a... I was jealous, man. This kid was playing Lynx on the school bus one day, and I was just like, oh, I want that.
Little did you know.
Little did I know how
crap.
Much it sucks. Right. I thought it looked awesome, dude. They were playing Paperboy.
Yeah, that's true. Probably the screen was pretty good.
It was. They were playing Paperboy, and I was like, dude. But I was not missing anything.
Nope.
All right. Well, with that said, I think it's time to talk about the 10 most definitive games for the console, so we will take a quick break, and we'll be right back with number 10. All right, Brandon, it's time to talk about the most definitive games for the N64. What is our number 10 choice? And yep. I have no, but just as a reminder to everybody, I have no idea how they exactly stacked up. I know what my list was, I don't know what Brandon's list is, and I don't know how they all shook out.
Right.
With that said, take it away.
So our number 10 is GoldenEye 007. So,
man, this is the game that shook the world.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you... wanted to come up with some of like the most played game and like some the most identifiable games for the system, and just like one of the games that is like most thought of as like the multiplayer thing that you had to have.
Or I would go a level further and I would say that are just like the damn zeitgeist of the era.
Right.
And I would say like the what Halo was to the Xbox original, this game was to the N64 in terms of like, it didn't matter if you ever played a Mario game in your life. If you were playing lacrosse and shit, and like, you know, because there were lacrosse kids at my school, and they don't play video games. They played GoldenEye.
Right.
You
right. know? And like, this was a game that essentially paved the way for first person shooters on console, right? Halo would take that even further. But this was like, you know, first person shooters really didn't exist on home consoles prior to this, right? And this was like one of the first ones that broke their own popularity and to like do it reasonably well in terms of controlling it. So, and it was a licensed game to boot based on a movie, a James Bond movie. But I mean, this is a game that pretty much everyone had who was playing N64.
Everyone had it. It was four player. Some of the little notable things about it is screen cheating was a big factor. So, like, obviously, it's four players, but they're all on the same screen.
And you could see where your buddy was, and, you know, waiting for you.
These were CRTs, so they weren't 80 inches. You know what I mean? So it's not like you had to look way over. Like, it's, like, right there.
Yep.
So people would, you know, do that, and then everybody would get mad. Like, you're screen cheating. You saw me around that corner, and you, you know, blah, blah, blah. Nothing you can do about it. People did some elaborate things where they would, like, put paper on the TV and like
cardboard to like section it off.
Yeah, that was just cool. You know, you gotta love the ingenuity. But people just love these games. And the thing about them was too, you could set one of the big things about this game was playing the campaign was like not what anybody did much. Maybe
It was still really good. It was really fun.
Yeah, but what people did was they played. If you played it, it was almost like your tutorial to play the multiplayer. And then when you got to the multiplayer, there was all these parameters you could set,
all sorts of ways to customize.
And everybody liked Golden Gun. I remember.
Yeah, kill the man with the Golden Gun. Yeah. Which is a Golden Gun was one shot kill gun. And then there would be like big head mode and like paintballs and like you could do like lasers only, you know, and all sorts of like stuff to like or like just like rocket launchers and proximity mines. And like I just had just endless amount of fun playing this with friends and family during the time.
It was a heck of a game. Now, for me, it wasn't like a game that I played a whole lot of, but it's a game that's just, I mean, even to this day, very recently people still play it.
And it just got the re-release,
and it just got two re-releases. It got one on Xbox, and it got one on Switch.
Switch Online, yeah.
Yeah, and both of them are good in their own ways. Like, and people are still, like, the anticipation was huge. In this day and age, for those games, it's pretty crazy. It also spawned. I don't believe this game is anywhere else on our list. Perfect
Dark. No, it is.
So we got to talk about that now.
Yeah.
So there was sort of the spiritual successor to GoldenEye was Perfect Dark.
Made by Rare as well.
Also.
But here's like an original IP.
New IP. Joanna Dark is the main character. It had it. And this game, I believe this had some sort of thing with like an expansion pack or something like that.
I probably did.
I think you needed it to be able to play this. But this game, it was like really pushing the hardware, like incredibly far. I think it even had a mode where like two people could play on one controller or something.
I don't know.
Anyway, there was a lot of weird shit going on. But Perfect Dark, I was not my thing. But for a lot of people, like the people that love GoldenEye, love GoldenEye. But there were people that loved GoldenEye and were obsessed with it. Those people moved on to Perfect Dark in many cases. And it was basically like the better version of GoldenEye's multiplayer.
Right.
More advanced, I should say. Not better, but more advanced.
Yep.
So that's one we had to mention.
Yeah, and Rare were really the kings, like a huge mainstay of like the N64. They had tons of releases, tons of hits, and you know that won't be the last Rare game on our list, but
it's
one of the most significant games from the N64, and we, you know, it just had to be here, obviously. So
awesome. Number nine.
So our number nine is Super Smash Bros.
Okay.
So this is where the series,
my least favorite franchise ever. No, I'm just
least
kidding.
Favorite.
I don't like Smash Bros. Just historically, Smash Bros. Is a game that I know how great it is. I know how brilliant it is. I admire it so much.
It's a celebration of video games. Not even Nintendo anymore. Just video games.
I know, and I just don't like playing it. I'd rather watch it. I'd rather play Subspace Emissary single player. I just don't want to play it. But I know how good it is. It's
not even the Spirits.
Spirits, all right. It's all right. Yeah. I just don't like this. I don't like the mechanics of I'm lifting off of this platform. Oh, wait, what's my gravity? Okay, good. I can come back down. Oh, God. Oh, wait. Oh, fuck. I can come back down. And like, or I'm falling off the edge. Oh, wait. Oh, I can grab back up. The whole game, when you're not good at it, which is me at that game, is either, oh, I think I'm going to fly off into the stratosphere, or, oh, I think I'm falling off the edge the whole time. I don't enjoy it. I don't find it fun. It's brilliant. I just don't like it.
Yeah.
But it's so iconic.
Yeah. And this is where the series got its start. It was such a novel concept, the idea of at the time. Now it's just all of sort of Nintendo's greatest characters coming together for this sort of
battle royale
party battle royale fighting game. But then also all sorts of cool mini games like the break the targets and, you know, fighting a bunch of, you know, duplicate enemies and all the like little things that you would do in between and like the little extras and all the items that you would get, the references to all the other games. It was just, like I said, it was a celebration of Nintendo, and then it it only grew and grew and grew to now it's a whole celebration of all of video games, you know, with all sorts of third-party
characters. How does Super Smash 64 stack up against the subsequent titles?
Yeah, so my opinion would be that this is like, it's the most primitive and it's the worst of them. Like, I think it becomes debatable. You know, people might want to debate things. I think Smash Ultimate is the ultimate now in terms of playing Smash Bros. But whereas I think Melee and Brawl, like, there was arguments there. But it's not something like, it's definitely like become outdated now. But at the time, like, I was playing a ton of Smash Bros.
Were you?
Just by myself with friends, whatever, right? I mean, I was just.
Did you have a main?
Unlocking all the. Samus was my main back then.
That's cool that you remember, even though it might have changed.
Yeah. This is where, like, I discovered, like, Earthbound. You know, like, that was the cool thing about, like, you know, like, I didn't know who Ness was or what that was.
I'm glad you pointed that out. Like, a lot of people never thought before this game about what's inside the Metroid suit or who's in there. Like, right. Yeah, some people beat it and got the thing where you see it's a woman inside. But, like, for a lot of games, you know, like Fire Emblem, in many ways, became famous through Smash Brothers
through
in
Melee,
the States.
Yeah.
In the
yep.
States.
Yep. Yep.
Same thing as, like Samus as a character, right? Or like you said, Ness. You know, these are all characters that just didn't, they weren't iconic or nearly as iconic, and they certainly weren't mass appeal until Smash.
Yep. Yeah, I think, like, Smash, like, especially, like, once you get to, like, Melee, just, like, all the references and trophies you could find.
Stickers
like,
or whatever they are.
Yeah, like, and just, like, learn about, like, Nintendo's history. Like, they have, like, stuff in there, like, all the toys they were making before they became a video game company and stuff. It's just so cool, like, how much history is, like, chalked into these games.
Yeah, it's, and then, again, talking about reaching forward into the future, it's been imitated hundreds of 30 times probably, never beaten,
right?
Never beaten, no matter what. Nobody makes a better Smash Brothers than Nintendo does. Nobody makes a better Battle Royale brawler than Nintendo does. There are some other games that are kind of cool, but nothing even holds a candle. Nothing comes close. And a lot of that comes down to Sakurai, and he is like, this is his baby, and it's awesome that Nintendo let him do it. Yeah. Quite frankly, they said,
and it's also like the heavy hitters that Nintendo has, like in terms of just characters and brand, right? I mean,
yeah.
Nobody has the staple of characters that they do,
and no and no game highlights and celebrates that more than Smash does. So cool.
Yep.
All right, so let's go on to number eight.
So number eight is another game I've sunk tons of hours into, both single player and multiplayer, and that is Mario Kart 64.
Okay. All right.
So
another one that you probably wouldn't play today versus the others. Still,
I mean, yes, like Mario Kart 8 is so good, but
that's true.
I would go back to this.
There are battle mode. Yeah, there's some good.
Oh, yeah, that's true. The multiplayer battle modes have never really been topped from
this
game, I feel like.
That's true. Never mind. I stand corrected.
Yeah. While the original Mario Kart on Super Nintendo, I feel like isn't very, you know, I just don't really care for it that
or
much.
Or like the one on Game Boy Advance.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to play that. Super Circuit or whatever.
But this game, I feel like was the first truly awesome Mario Kart game for me, at least.
Yeah, this is the one where it started to feel like legit. Like a legit, like, let's play competitively and like there's some skill involved. I know it's goofy and like there's weapons and items and stuff, but it just feels like, I don't know, it feels like it's sophisticated enough that it feels like there's like a competitive game to be had there.
Yeah, and it sort of like sparked its own kind of kart racing genre in a way, right? Whereas Diddy Kong Racing also was during this time, right, by Rare, similar thing.
A lot of people love it.
There was like hovercraft and flying and stuff. I never really liked it as much as Mario Kart. I always felt like Mario Kart was my thing. I would still go back to play Mario Kart right now. If someone was like, hey, let's play Mario Kart on N64, I'd be like, I'm down for
it. Yeah, I would too. I would too. Certainly rather than Smash. I'm just kidding. But seriously, like Mario Kart never, ever since the 64 up through today, every one of the games is fun.
Yeah.
And that game is really the beginning of just like, yes. And it really exemplifies what you mentioned earlier, that this was the console about people getting together. And the fact that it had four controller ports just was so perfect for GoldenEye and Perfect Dark.
And Super Smash Bros.
And Super Smash Bros. And this game. Yeah. Like, are you kidding me? You know?
Yeah. and one other game that's coming up on our list as well. So
excellent, man. I'm in it. I'm in bated breath anticipation. I guess really not much else to say about Mario Kart. Everybody that's listening to this knows what it is.
Yeah.
Everybody listening to this knows how awesome it is.
This is like the first great start of it, I think.
Yeah. Yep. Awesome. All right, man. Let's move on to number seven.
So our number seven is Star Fox 64. This is just one of my favorite games just in general of all time. The amount of times I've played through Star Fox 64 is ridiculous. There was like one day I remember where I was like just running through it, like all the different paths you could go. And then I remember I had my mom take a picture of my like final score so I could send it into Nintendo Power.
Oh, wow.
You know, because I just had like dominated like a run. Because like, I was like, because you could like beat the game. Like if you're really good at it, like you could beat the game in like an hour. Like if you knew exactly where to go, get all the shortcuts, like go through and get the real ending.
Did
and everything.
You play it again on, was it 3DS that it came out on?
Yeah.
Did you play it again there?
That's a cool version.
Was it
as
fun?
Well. Yeah, yeah. But I mean, Star Fox and SNES is way too primitive for me.
Yeah.
Whereas this game is just, it's just a huge leap forward.
Yeah,
awesome.
The SNES, it's just like shapes moving through the air. And this one, it's like, okay, now that's a ship.
Yeah, and then all the, you know, talking with the other members of your crew and
Slippy
the bosses.
And Peppy.
Slippy,
and
Falco, Peppy, yeah. And then like the other characters you would meet. And then just the fact that you could take different paths based on what you do in certain levels. You would see a map of all these planets and systems. But if you know, one path, you would miss like half those planets. But like you were like, how can I get to that planet? You know, well, there was a certain condition you had to meet or a certain way you had to go or whatever to take that path. And it would change the story. And there was even a real ending and a fake ending, you know, depending on what you did. And
Andross, good enemy.
Right.
What I will say is this game, when you just play it back for me, when I think of the four main characters, what a great cast.
Yeah.
What a great world building that game brought. I mean, it's just every one of the four main cast members just has like a very distinct personality, yet they're not just stupid in one note. They just really make it, they bring so much more color and life to the game. It really well done.
And then you had the rival crew, Star Wolf, right, where that they were enemies, right? Like, and there was an analog to each character. And then, so it would basically be like an on-rail shooter where you're in a ship, controlling a ship, you can move around, but you're always moving forward. But then there would also be these levels where you would enter, or it would just be an all range mode level, or that's where you were flying around, you know, in all directions, and, you know, you were free to like fly all around. And then you would also fly in like different ship types, right, where you had the tank and, you know, obviously the main ship. So I love this game. I sunk countless hours into this one.
Yeah. Awesome. You know, I've definitely played it. I enjoyed it. I think this is one though that everybody knows. It's just a stone cold classic. Mm-hmm. It's a classic of replayability. This is a game that it may not be the longest game ever made, and it's one that you just know you're going to play 150 times if you want to play it right. And that's different. Like, not every game is built that way, but this game is for insane replayability. So, got to give it points for that. All right, I think that takes us to number six.
All right, so our number six game is kind of a cheat because we're doing three games into one, and that is Mario Party 1, 2, and 3. I feel like they're all so similar, you know, in spirit and everything. Like, you know, it's hard to just single out one, so I just bundled them all together.
I think it makes sense. I mean, the thing about it is, like, different ones brought different things to the party.
The party.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, it's true. Like, different, you know, the very first one was the template. And then there was the second one, which brought additional characters into it and additional sort of gameplay mechanics. But every one of them has its own unique mini games. I wouldn't say that of these three games, one of them has like, oh, those are the best mini games or whatever.
Right, right.
I think oftentimes, I think two is considered the best.
I feel like two is considered the one people remember was, because remember one had all those games where you had to rotate the stick.
Yeah.
And people would use their their palm.
Yep.
And Nintendo actually had to sell a glove that you could request because people were like wearing the skin off their palm. Do you remember that?
I didn't know
there
that.
Was a special glove you could get through Nintendo Power because of that.
That's
and
awesome.
I was definitely one of them. I remember playing this with my cousin like all day long. Like, we from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. just played Mario Party 1, you know, over and over again, like playing each other like it was a board game or something, right? And just our palms were like raw by the time we were done.
Yeah. But I mean, yeah, this is, again, think about how revolutionary Nintendo is to come up with this concept. You know, it's just like
a digital board game with Mario characters.
Yeah. Again, it's just like the start of something. There's now what? 13, 14, 15
like
of them?
10 numbered ones to other mainline, and then like a ton of spinoff ones.
Every console had at least one or two. Yeah, there's tons that like collect the greatest hits of them. And once again, four players plugged into those four damn ports.
I told you another one was coming.
Yeah, that's the one. That's the one, yeah. But no, these games are excellent. And again, if we sat down right now and you said, can we play Mario Party 2 or 3 or 1? I'd say, hell yeah,
yeah.
Let's go. You know, two people, great. Three people, great. Four people, best.
This is another one I spend like a ton of time with. I feel like my view on these games and this series like soured a little bit because they just made so many of them.
They bad ones. Like when they started making characters jump in the same car together, it sucked.
Yeah, but I fell off. I just remember I was talking about this to you recently, but I just fell off after the N64 because I felt like they were making so many of them and so little was really changing. It was just like, all right.
Well, everyone
like,
had
I've
different mini games. Some of them were similar, though.
But you know what I mean. Like, it's not. Yeah, the mini games are different, but they're just variations on. Like,
and they aren't so iconic in most cases that it's like, oh my god, these mini games in this one are so much better and shit. You know.
Yeah, and then even though I soured on the series a little bit, I can't deny like how much time I played these games. You know, on the N64. So, you know, good pick that they're here on the list.
All right, well, that's the top half down.
Yep.
Let's move on to number 5, and now we're in the top half.
The upper echelon.
Yeah, this is this now it's ridiculous. These games are ridiculous. All right, let's hit it.
So our number 5 is Banjo-Kazooie.
Oh, man.
I love this game. I play, and although there was a sequel, Banjo-Tooie, which I felt like was too ambitious and like they got too big with it, Banjo-Kazooie, I felt, is just
you mean
perfect.
Like Banjo-Tooie much?
Tooie much.
Okay.
but the creativity, another rare game, just the creativity of this, all the different worlds and just the British humor in it and just the dichotomy of the two characters' abilities, like Banjo and Kazooie. Just so cool, just so memorable. I just vividly I could picture like all the levels and
so many people have tried to make like
including Rare, right? Like try to recapture the magic.
Yes, but I was actually gonna say Sly Cooper, what do you call those,
like a 3D mascot platformers.
Yeah. So many people have tried to make like memorable mascots and mascot platformers, and so few do it memorably. And Banjo-Kazooie, the characters are great. The way you control them feels great. It is a little bit like of a, you know, just like a fetch quest. The game, if you distill it down to its core elements,
like a collect-a-thon style 3D platformer.
But if you enjoy the trappings of the journey, so like if you think about what you're doing in it, it's a little bit like, oh, okay, so this one I push down different letters on the floor and I get my puzzle jiggy. This one you could distill it down in your head and ruin the magic, or you could just take in the world that you're in and the joy that you're experiencing, and then you can find an amazing game here. So there's some people that are just like, I hate Banjo-Kazooie. It's just like, okay, now where's the next thing to go collect? Oh, do I have 50? Do I have 100? Who gives a shit? And then there are some people who are like, nah, man, like this game is life.
Right.
And it's that kind of game, you know? And I'd say more in the latter category.
Yeah, for sure. I think most people, you know, remember this game very fondly who, you know, were growing up during that era.
And then Rare has just, like, not wanted to give us more of it. They were just like, nuts and bolts, here you go.
Yeah, like, that was some of the weirdest. Like, they did Banjo-Tooie, which is a similar game.
Oh, I meant after those.
Yeah, and then there was, like, a Game Boy Advance one or whatever. But, yeah, like, why they decided to do nuts and bolts, like, and just have it basically focus on vehicle construction. Still don't understand it.
It's not a terrible game, but, like, man, why?
It just doesn't make sense for a Banjo-Kazooie game.
So much so that there had to be, like, other people who made ukulele and stuff.
The people that came from Rare and stuff, yeah.
To try to recapture some of that magic, so. Anyway, awesome. So that's...
But
what else
I mean,
about it?
This, like, influenced me. Like, I remember during this time, it was like anything that had like a cool character on the box, like I would, you know, because like you said, like after this, like mascot platformers like become huge, like after Mario 64 and Banjo-Kazooie, like everyone was like, where can we break through with the next like cool
Arrow
character?
The Acrobat, right? You know what I mean, or whatever.
Glover and Gex and you know Chameleon Twist and all these games, right? Like and like some of them like did it well, like Jack and Dexter, Ratchet and Clank, or Sly Cooper. I think, you know, those came later. But like Crash Bandicoot, Spyro, like there were good ones, but this was the point where we were just inundated with like throwaway characters and like, you know, crappy 3D platformers.
Where do you come down? I don't think this is on our list. Donkey Kong 64.
Right, it's not on our list.
Where do you come down on that game?
I like some parts of it, but this is where they went way overboard with the collectibles. Yeah. I mean, there's like Donkey has like a great video on this where he's like, there are over 7 billion bananas to collect, like, and you can't even just pick up the bananas. They're all color coded to all the different Donkey, like the different Kongs. So it's like, then you have to go and like switch the Kong, go back, collect their color banana. Yeah. Like, you know, it's just, it was just too,
I didn't
control.
Like it. I just didn't like it at all. And you know, that's just, to me, I was playing it and I was like, yeah, I don't, this is not what. First of all, it's a totally different game than any other Donkey Kong game, country game.
Yeah.
And second of all, it's just not great. You know, I think it's not a bad game.
No, it's not a bad game, but it was more about just collecting things than platforming.
It shows off the elegance of the original Banjo-Kazooie, of just how elegantly done
how
it was.
How simpler it was, and
but just the beautiful simplicity of it. Like, simple versus complex is one thing, but like magical is yet another. Yeah. And that's where Banjo-Kazooie comes in, I think.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, so that takes us to number 4.
Yep, our number 4 is The Legend of Zelda: Majora's Mask.
All right. And the thing that hurt this one is that I personally have not played it to completion, so I couldn't put it.
That's crazy to me.
I know. It is. Like, it's crazy.
Is this the only Zelda, like, mainline Zelda game that you haven't
played to completion? Let me think. It depends on how you characterize mainline. So, like, I don't think I played, like, the Oracle games all the way through.
Okay, I would consider those mainline, yeah.
Okay, even though they're Capcom?
Yeah.
Okay. So those... That's pretty much it. Yeah, I played Skyward. I played the hell out of the realistic one. I'm blanking on it right now with the Wolf Link.
Twilight Princess.
Yep.
Twilight Princess, Wind Waker.
I played them all.
How about the A Link Between Worlds?
You played that? Yeah. Okay, I love that. Yeah.
Sounds like
I played
this
Phantom
is like
Hourglass.
One of the few that you haven't.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that like I just missed it in its day, and a lot of people did. This is a big game that a lot of people went back to. Like, a lot of people went back to Majora's Mask when they heard how great it was. Because at the time, it was like, okay, here is, you know, the main game. And then Majora's was the sort of, like, rework.
Like an asset flip, kind of.
Yeah. I think there's no way to talk about this without talking about Ocarina. So, Ocarina, obviously, is legendary, and it may or may not be later on our list. But, essentially, the idea, talk about the idea behind Majora's Mask. What were they doing?
So Majora's Mask was a quick turnaround time. I think it only came out 2 years or so after Ocarina.
Between 1 and 2. It was like real fast.
So essentially it's using the same like graphic engine and assets. However, they're taking a totally different direction, that it takes place in another world called Termina. And the whole crux of the game is that the moon's going to crash into the Earth in 3 days. And Link has sort of arrived to avert that disaster. And to do that, he has to play through the same 3 days over and over again, aka like something like Groundhog's Day, the movie, and basically keep his items across each time reset, and like use all the things he's learned to kind of take that, you know, use that to your advantage to solve the puzzle in the allotted 3 days. And masks were like a huge feature of this game, where, you know, there were all sorts of masks that gave Link different abilities, including masks that would turn him into different species like a Deku Scrub or a Zoro or a Goron, etc. So it's probably the most darkest of all the Zelda games, you know, considering that there's impending doom. All these people you meet are going to die. And just a very darker, sinister tone just overarching the whole game. But it's I always go back and forth. Like, I'm like, is Majora's Mask my favorite Zelda game? Maybe today it is. Maybe, you know what I mean? Like, it's definitely up there. Like, it's one of, there's nothing quite like it. And I just love the whole, like 3-day time mechanic. I just love that idea, where it's like, you're using the things you learn to like know where what things are happening at what time of day, when, you know, and you have a notebook in the game.
It sounds stressful to me. I know it's not. I know it's fun.
Right. I mean, and there's a way to slow time down, and you just have to know that, like, hey, like in this loop, I'm going to do this. I'm focusing on this dungeon or whatever, right? So it was like the death loop, but way before death loop, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And probably a more like better version of it even. But yeah, I mean, I love this game. I think I understand like how the time mechanic can turn people off, but I think if you sort of embrace it,
you
got
to give yourself over to it. It's that kind of game, and people, you know, I have it, you know, ready to go on my 3DS anytime I want to play it. I just need to take the time. What is it, 20 hours? You think?
Yeah, probably somewhere 20 to 30 hours, something like that.
It's an in-depth game. I need to play it. This is one of the big, I'd say, it's top 10 omissions in my retro history.
Yeah.
I know it. I've known it. But that's the thing, too, about this era. Like, I wasn't playing games, like, encyclopedically, like I do now. Like, now I want to play everything important, always. And I go back, you know, in the last couple of generations, I've been that way. But at this point, I wasn't like that, you know.
Right.
So, this was a big gap.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah, but anyway,
it's definitely one of the weirdest Zelda games for sure, but in a good way.
Yeah, it's a lot of people's favorite Zelda game, and on certain days, it's yours as well.
Yeah,
so
it's definitely in the running for one of my favorites.
Awesome. All right, number three.
Yep, which is Paper Mario.
All right, this is something that I just like. I feel like, first of all, it holds a nice place in our history, you and me.
Yep.
Because Thousand Year Door was a talking point from when we met, but I think we both hold this series in just tremendously high esteem. We talked a little bit on previous episodes and in different conversations about like Color Splash and some of the newer games and Origami King and all these games that like they haven't given us what we really want out of Paper Mario, but they still have some of the ingredients. And the thing about Paper Mario series that you have to understand, and nobody wants to understand it, and I kind of don't want to understand it either, and that is that they had a premise from the very beginning that they were never going to make the same game twice. Like they said that it's like a stated ambition of the series that every time they make a new Paper Mario, they want it to have new tenants and do new things. And so, you know, the first one was sort of like it was the next game after Super Mario RPG, and it was like this really cool new paper-style game. It's got this, you know, amazing RPG mechanics. It's kind of a hardcore RPG, kind of, but with this amazing cast of colorful characters. It's probably the closest thing to Mario RPG of anything that you could ever get, really. And the game has just slowly but surely moved kittier as it goes. Obviously, Thousand Year Door, which came after it, is the
it's just
pinnacle.
Like a bigger dial it up to 11 version of this
game. Is the pinnacle of a pinnacle of the form, and then ever since then it's been doing like there was Super Paper Mario,
which I really like.
I really like it too.
As different as it is,
I really like that game too. It is not what we thought we wanted, but it is awesome. And then the games, they go downhill in one sense, but what never stops is the unbelievable like humor and fun and joy, and it's like Paper Mario finds a different vector of a different it's like if there's a kaleidoscope, like this is looking through a different pane at like the Mario world, you know what I mean? It's like a different way to, and in that same light, there are so many games on this console that we're talking about now, the 64. I'm actually talking about it, I'm appreciating it a little bit more, but which is how it should be, right? But we talked about how there's so many games on here that celebrate Nintendo and what Nintendo is great at. And even to this day, these are great celebrations. And Paper Mario is no exception. It's another way to celebrate this amazing universe that you would think is stupid and silly. Like, Mario, like, he was Jumpman. He's just a plumber because, like, those colors looked blocky and good. I mean, it's just, it doesn't have these amazing, like, lofty origins. But it's just come to be this series with these characters and these stories and these, and this world is so amazing. And there's so many ways they flesh it out. And I think Paper Mario is one of the most interesting Mario takes.
Yes.
There are.
Because you're going to all these sort of wacky areas of the Mushroom Kingdom and beyond, right, that you never would see in the mainline series, meeting all these wacky characters that, you know, most people have heard of Mario, and he's like this famous guy, right? Like,
yeah.
You're just meeting all these people, meeting all these wacky characters, wacky villains outside of like the type of enemies and archetypes that are in the mainline Mario series, or they even play with it, where like Koopas would normally be your enemy, but maybe now, you know, one of your party members is a Koopa or a Goomba or a Bomb or whatever, right? And it's just cool, like, see, and for some reason their philosophy became like they didn't want to create like original characters anymore. Everything like was just like, just make it a Toad, you know what?
Yeah,
I mean, like,
or a Goomba or whatever.
Yeah, like they were like, no, we're not gonna make like original enemies or species or enemy,
and,
you know what I mean?
And I
like,
think part of that probably, again, this is that wild hair that's up Nintendo's bum, right? About this idea of like they're crafting their universe and they're curating it very carefully, and they always have. And I think what it comes down to probably is at a certain point they were like, it's getting too big. You know what I mean? But okay, but let Paper Mario be weird. You know what I mean? And like, let other games rein it in, you know, but this is the place to let it be weird. And they just wouldn't, you know, is what it is.
Yeah. But this is where it got its start, and it's a great, great RPG. One of the only RPGs really on the Nintendo 64. It was not known for its RPGs, but I think this is pretty much the best.
It wasn't just not known for them. It was a desert.
It was. Yeah, exactly. There's only probably a handful of them, and this is probably the best one for sure, like definitively.
Awesome. All right, so that takes us to number two. Mm-hmm. All right, let's cook it.
So our number two was number two on both of our lists, and that is Super Mario 64. So the game that really redefined defined what 3D gaming would look like after it released, I mean, just so many memories with this, like, just like exploring Peach's Castle, like realizing you could jump into the paintings and those would take you to a different worlds, and just like messing around in the courtyard, like for the first time, like getting used to the controls and like what Mario could do. It was just truly amazing. The imagination of this, like, I remember like going into the, little courtyard area within the castle and like, realizing you could jump into like the Boo's cage and like go into the Boo house, like, and like all the crazy stuff that would happen in there. I mean, it was just awesome. I mean, what are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, I think one of the things about it, and I don't know if this was ever done before this, but I don't think so, this idea of a world that you would re-enter. So each one is a diorama, mm-hmm. right? And it would have different features based on which star you were chasing. So that was cool.
True,
it also had this cool hub world, right, which was the castle and the surrounding grounds. And so you would enter these paintings, and when you entered the painting, you'd choose which star you were chasing. And I think there was one you had to start with, but then after that, you could, like, move on to others. And so you essentially would, once you were done, kind of like, this is going to be a weird comparison. It's a little like Hitman, the modern Hitman, in the sense that you go into that world, and then like you go into it from 15 different perspectives after,
right.
You know, and you essentially, when you're done playing that world, you know it cold, even though it changes a bit from attempt to attempt, you know it like front to back when you're done, and it feels great. So it's a very economical thing if you think about it, because like, imagine you're making fully 3D worlds back when you used to be making side scrollers where all you need to do is draw one screen, and now you got to make a world, right? Makes a whole lot of sense to have five levels in one level, you know?
Yeah.
And that was just a super smart economic decision that actually paid huge dividends. Same thing with Star Fox. Maybe that was their thinking. They were like, we can't make a 15-hour straight front-to-back Star Fox. We can't afford to. It'll never be done. So let's make one where you take different paths through the levels and you replay it. And the same thing is the case here. And yep. I think it's brilliant. This is not my favorite Mario. It never was my favorite Mario, but it is as iconic and influential as almost any game that was ever made. It started a genre that I am passionately in love with, and what came next was like the refinement of the formula that made it unbelievable. Now, some people think Mario 64 is like one of the greatest 3D platformers ever made in addition to being the roadmap. I'm not in that camp, but you cannot overstate its significance.
Yeah. I mean, I'm kind of like more in the camp of like, well, I don't necessarily, like, I wouldn't, like, I think I would be like you, and I wouldn't agree that it was the best 3D platformer still. I think it's still close. Like,
oh, wow.
I think as old as it is, like, it still plays very well, and it would, I think it would definitely be like one of the, it's still one of the greatest 3D platformers ever made. So
interesting.
As good as like Odyssey is, and like all, you know, and how much I liked Galaxy and all that, like,
None of those are as distilled, though, because those games were all, they all had to a new angle on it. So Galaxy's mm-hmm. about the planetoids and the shooting stars and all that stuff.
And it was more like a linear thing. Yeah.
Odyssey was about,
I feel like Odyssey was like the first reimagining of this exact formula.
Nonetheless, though, it had the hats, and it had, you know, it just had mm-hmm. it just had different things. You're right, it really was, but it was very different in fundamental ways. This was just like the core expression, right? And there's not ever going to be, just by the nature of human beings and the desire to iterate, there's never going to be something that's this pure ever again.
Yeah. Because
they'll always have to tinker with it. They'll always have to mess with it.
Just think of the leap in imagination from Mario World to this. I mean, it's staggering, really, that they pulled it off and stuck the landing with such a flourish, you know what I mean,
yeah.
on their first attempt. That's mind-blowing.
It's mind-blowing. It's really mind-blowing. The game is ridiculous. It's ridiculous. I will say this, though. I always felt a little out of control. I never felt perfectly in control of my character. And that's, it may be a feature, not a bug, but to me, I've never felt like, in every game since then, I felt like rock-solid control over my character. In this game, I feel a little out of control. That may just be me.
I agree with you, I think. Yeah. I agree.
Doesn't mean
bit.
It's not amazing.
Like,
but
going back to it, there, you know, with the 3D All-Stars collection,
yeah.
you know, and playing through all three of those games all over again, like, I think I agree that, like, Sunshine feels a little tighter, you know, like, and Galaxy plays a little differently, like, just in general, like, it's fundamentally a slightly different kind of game, but I see that. I agree with that, but like, I think it's still very much playable today, and
oh, yeah.
its historical significance.
And there's been good remakes, too. Like, the DS version's
yeah.
fun, and,
yeah.
and you can play it a couple different virtual consoles, different ways and places. It's the kind of game that also, like, it's so iconic and so beloved that it's actually had so much of a life after the 64. Because, as you said, the 64 sold 30-plus million copies, 17th most popular. You know, it wasn't that prolific, and so there's been so many ways to experience it since, and a lot of times, like, it's the first game or the fifth game or whatever that people put on, like, Android devices or whatever. They're like, I'm gonna hack 64 to work on this, you know, similar to the way that, like, what is it, Doom, that plays on everything or whatever. It's like, maybe that might be the first game, but this might be the fifth. Like, there's a lot, people love putting Mario 64 on things because it's just fun to play, and it's simple, and it's, anyway, it's a great game. It just can't and honestly, like, I don't think any game on this list, or on any list maybe, would be more influential, maybe, possibly. It's up there. It's top five most influential games of all time. I'll say that.
Yeah, the original Super Mario Brothers, certainly. But
yeah, but I would say top five in terms of influence. I mean, Zelda, one of them we'd have to pick at least, if not two of them. But yeah, I almost think four of the five are probably those four games. Yeah. You know what I mean? The 2D version of each and the 3D version of each
yeah.
are kind of like four of the five most influential games of all time. And maybe five is Final Fantasy VII. And then maybe we're done, you know?
Yeah.
That's a drastic oversimplification, but
yeah. But yeah, I mean, and it's just awesome, like, watching speedrunners of this. Like, it just has its own language, you know, this game. I feel like it just, there's something where, once again, I could just sort of recall, like, all the different worlds and everything, you know, like, and cursing the clock level TikTok clock and the rainbow ride at the end, like, that drove me crazy as a kid. I really love this game.
All right, man, well, that can only leave one game. We all know what it is. Our number one.
So I think this is probably the first perfect unanimous score we've had in any list we've done. Like,
yeah.
whether the top tens or like our other lists that we've done. So this was both our number one. So a maximum of 20 points, The Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time.
Yeah. I mean, if I hated this game, I don't.
You'd be a fool.
I'd be a fool. But if I hated this game, it still would be number one on the list. Because it's Ocarina. It's just definitive. There is nothing more definitive than ocarina. Like, people are just like, dude, ocarina, bro. You know, like, that's all you got to say. It's ocarina. It's the archetype for what it feels like to be a wide-eyed adventurer going on an amazing quest in 3D. This is that game.
Yep.
And yes, it has some faults, like the Water Palace did suck. But the game is just unreal. And the world you run around in with Epona is kind of sparse. But what it does right is just, it's mind-blowing.
Yeah.
I'm going to let you cue it up, though. So what is it about this that makes it so good?
Yeah, I think kind of like what you said, just the, once again, like going from A Link to the Past to this on its first try. And it did what so many 3D games that were transitioning, like, you know, because so many franchises were transitioning from like 2D to 3D, like, let's say like Castlevania or whatever.
Yikes.
Right? Like that couldn't pull it off. And like the fact that Nintendo could do it, and it even did it first, and games that came after it still couldn't pull it off. But like this 3D space, but like the Z targeting, like how brilliant was it? Like, you know, like the fact that it didn't have dual analog, like that wasn't a thing yet, but it had a solution for it, you know, by locking on, like having a way for your character to lock onto its target. Just the sense of adventure, like you said, like going around Hyrule Field, the fact that, you know, there was a day and night cycle, you know, like within the game, different things would happen, all the different areas and all the different dungeons
and the characters you meet.
Yep. And then you slap that there's a whole time travel element on top of this. So there's Link as a kid and Link as an adult. So it's the same world with different things going on simultaneously. I mean, the fact that this was their first game like this, and they did all, like, not only was all this included, but they pulled it off with the aplomb.
And that many people say it's the greatest game of all time.
Yeah, I mean,
video games of all time, Ocarina.
Yeah, it's definitely typically in the conversation for that. I mean, I remember it had, like, it was like, it was like one of the highest rated games ever, you know, at the time, you know, like with like a 99, you know, aggregate score.
And whoever the asshole was that didn't give it 100, yeah, right. Pissed, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, I mean, this was like my childhood during that time. I mean, just the amount of memories I have playing this game is all I have for a lifetime. Unless I have dementia, then I'll lose it then. But
and then let's just take it away. Let's say this game goes poof. But all we had left were all the things it influenced. Mm-hmm. That would be enough. It would the missing game, the empty spot, would still be number one.
Yep.
Because of what it's done, because of Wind Waker, because of Darksiders, because of a thousand other games that I can't think of right now. But there's a thousand games that are like this, where you're going through dungeons, gaining abilities, solving puzzles, killing monsters, and having a wholesome yet compelling, amazing adventure. It's just, the influence can't be overstated. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, and this also started like Zelda games, you know, having like a whole musical element associated with them, with the ocarina.
People think about how many people dress up as Zelda or have an ocarina that they play, or
yeah,
and how, you know, and then the songs, yeah, like the Song of Time,
because like songs became, you know, like in many Zelda games after this, there was some sort of musical instrument and songs that you were learning that would do different things, unlock everything. You know, Wind Waker had the Wind Waker, obviously, and Spirit Tracks at the flute, and just all sorts of stuff, right? So, I mean, it's one of my favorite games ever. It varies. Like, it's hard for me to even pick between Ocarina of Time and Majora's Mask, but it's hard to dispute with, like, the bigger game that came first. Yeah, one of my favorite games of all time, one of my most cherished games of all time.
All right. Well, with that said, we will drop the mic momentarily, and we'll be right back with our honorable mentions. All right, man. Well, here is arguably the most fun part, and that is to talk about some of our honorable mentions that didn't make the list. I'm going to go ahead and start.
Okay.
And I'm going to talk about something that I sort of alluded to earlier in the episode, and that is experiences that I had playing freaking Killer Instinct. So I liked Killer Instinct on SNES, but Killer Instinct Gold for me was so much fun. Combo Breaker right. Is like somewhat of the soundtrack of the we used to have it was called ample storage space, where we used to set up our music equipment. We also had a TV in there. It was like a cheap Samsung that came from when I was in college, and my N64 and like a couple games. I think we had War Gods. And we had like, I think Clay Fighter, whatever, 63 and a third. And then we had, you know, the normal games that everybody has. And then we had Killer Instinct Gold, and Killer Instinct Gold never came out of the thing. We loved that game. Glacius and all of the different characters in that were
Spinal.
I love Spinal. Spinal wins. I love that game. I love that game so much that I thought it was other people's favorite game, like of that era. And I found out I was wrong. But I love that game. I think Killer Instinct is absolutely amazing. I can't stand how good it is. And we had so much fun. And the best thing about it was, I've never really been that good at fighting games, ever. But for some reason, me and my friends were all like equally good at that shit. I don't know how it was so good at equalizing us, but it was never like, oh, dude, Elliot's way better than me. Or, oh, Robert kicks my ass every time. Or, oh, I'm so good at it that nobody ever wants to fight me because I'm too good. That never happened. It was always a good fight. And sometimes somebody would get an edge with their character, right? And so then all of a sudden it's like, oh, fuck, you keep winning. This is bullshit or whatever. But most of the time it was super balanced and super fun and cartoony, but yet brutal. It's just a great game. You ever play it?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
not a huge fan.
I played the SNES version more. Yeah, it's good. I mean, it's a interesting game. Once again, Rare made this.
Dude.
It's definitely not my favorite, but it had cool characters and stuff for sure. And I remember it more so in the arcades, like this version of the game, like in the arcades. It was pretty cool.
Cool, man. I'm going to do one more, and then we'll do two of yours. Is that good?
Sure.
So this one was on my list actually pretty high, but it just got knocked off when we combined everything together. But this is one of my top five favorite games in terms of or top six, somewhere in there, favorite games on the N64, and that is 1080 Snowboarding. This game... So what's really notable is I don't like sports games that much.
But there have been notably a lot on your list, you know, especially your NES list, right?
Yeah, interestingly. Well, especially back then.
Yeah.
Nowadays, I don't play almost any sports games. But back then, there were sports games that broke through for me. Extreme sports more often. But I love 1080 Snowboarding. It was simple enough. I think that's the thing about sports games in that era. And a lot of people will tell you this. They're like, oh, Madden's too complicated for me now. And if I really wanted to sit down and figure it out, I play games all the time. I could figure it out. But I just don't care enough to do that. But back then, you didn't have to. Like, I played 1080, probably put 200 hours into that game. That's how much I loved, like, trying to get better times down that damn mountain and carving. And I love that game. And a lot of people will say it's the best realistic snowboarding game on the console. I absolutely agree. It's probably the snowboarding game I've enjoyed the most in my life of playing video games. I love 1080. I think it's a blast. And just putting it on or hearing the music or seeing it just like brings a smile to my face. Love, love, love some 1080. And I believe it had two player. I feel like I played it with people as well. I forget all the details.
I think so, yeah.
Did you ever play it at all?
Yeah. I mean, I played a lot of this game.
Oh, yeah.
I remember it fondly. Like, I guess I don't, like, when I think about it now, for some reason, I'm like, yeah, whatever. I don't think I want to play that again. You know what I mean? I have it. But I definitely put a lot of time into it at the time. So I'm right there with you. Yeah, I mean, I remember it fondly. But for some reason, I think through the lens of like gaming now and looking back on that system, it's never one where I'm like, oh, I'm sure that's great to play today.
I feel that way before too. I think we may be wrong though. I think maybe if we popped it in, I think we might think it's more anyway.
And just I'm usually not craving to play like extreme sports games anymore either.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, you know, same thing with Tony Hawk. Like, I love Tony Hawk. I played a ton of it, but like, I'm not really like pining to go back to it either. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. What are two of your honorable mentions, man?
So I brought five, so I'll just go. I'll do my five and four really quickly. So my number five was Yoshi's Story. So while I don't think it's, you know, a great game, and, you know, especially compared to Yoshi's Island, I don't think they ever really recaptured the magic of Yoshi's Island on Super Nintendo. I played a ton of Yoshi's Story
fun.
For some reason.
It's fun.
Like collecting all the different colored Yoshis and just you know, all the fruits that you would eat. Yeah, and yeah. I just had a ton of fun with the game, even though I know it's like not necessarily like held in like super high regard, like in retrospective, but it was a game I played an absolute ton of, and I really liked the charm of it. My number four was probably an interesting choice. You ever play Gauntlet Legends? Great multiplayer game.
I think I have, but I don't remember the details.
Yeah, so it's in the Gauntlet series. You know, the classic arcade game.
Sort of ARPG, but without a lot of stats.
I mean, like a beat 'em up, top down beat 'em up, but like with some RPG elements, like Diablo or something like that. You would level up and you collected items. So I had a ton of fun of playing, you know, this multiplayer, especially with my cousin. So it was another 4-player capable game. And me and my cousin would just play it hours and hours and hours. And, you know, just you would pick like different characters, you know, like the warrior, the archer, the mage, you know, whatever. Right. And you would play and you would just like fight hordes of enemies and collect potions and keys and unlock treasure chests and get like better armor and items and stuff. And I just had a ton of fun playing. I think it's a very like underrated game in the library.
Nice.
So I'll do my number three.
Yeah, do that. Yeah.
It's a game I know that you haven't had much experience with, but I wish you had. Star Wars Rogue Squadron.
Oh, I
played an absolute ton.
I hear of great things.
I mean, it was peak days of Star Wars back then, and just I just love this game. You know, like flying the different rebel ships and, you know, all the different levels and stuff. It was just so much fun.
Nice. So I'm going to pull out one here. Turok, Dinosaur Hunter. I played a lot of that game, man. And when I go back to it and look at it now, it doesn't belong on the list of, like, holds up well today in the sense that, like, when I play it today, I'm like, wow, this looks, like, really, like...
They went crazy with that fog. Like, you can't, like, see, like, 3 feet in front
of you. And more than that, it just doesn't look sharp anymore. In my childhood memory, that game looked, like, sharp, and I was, like, killing dinosaurs, and I was, like... in a forest. Now I look at it and it's a bunch of like blur, right. You know, but that's somehow how it is. You know, that console was trying to punch way above its weight all the time. And this is some of the casualty of the 3D experience is that looking at it now, it just doesn't hold up. Yeah. But Turok Dinosaur Hunter was a blast to play. It was a great like single player campaign shooter. But it was with arrows. I mean, it was just a cool... I mean, it had other things.
Didn't you get regular guns? Yeah, so eventually,
But it just had its own tone. And I just remember feeling really good playing that game. And I felt like I felt the forward momentum and the progression and a lot of these things that I came to characterize what I love about good shooter campaigns. A lot of that stuff was sort of started there. So it's by no means like a masterpiece, but... It's a great game. I think there were two on the N64.
Three, actually.
Oh, there's a third? I didn't even know that. I played the two.
I think there's like a multiplayer-only game on top of that, too.
All on 64?
Yeah.
Wow, man. They went hard. But anyway, I really enjoyed Turok. Did you play it?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a classic game that a lot of people remember from this era. I think I'm with you there. Like, it hasn't aged well at all. Like, you know, it is tough to go back to. Number one, like, going back to just any first-person shooter on the N64 is tough, including GoldenEye and, you know, everything else, right? Perfect Dark. It's really hard to control, like, because you have like lateral movement but very little like vertical move, you know what I mean? Like,
yep.
So it was also like I always remember it was very confusing, like knowing where to go because there was like no map system, or and then combine that with the fog effects. But it was cool. I mean, anything fighting, you were fighting dinosaurs
different.
Back then.
Yeah.
I mean, that wasn't like a common thing. I think it was the second one that added the cerebral bore weapon, like where it would like drill into the enemy's head. Like
I remember that
being crazy. Turok was cool. And the remakes have fixed a lot of those issues that we talked about where they kind of modernized it, like got rid of the fog effects and kind of improved it a little bit. So those are maybe worth checking out.
What are they? The remakes?
Yeah, the two remakes on Switch. For Turok 1 and 2.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Huh. I should check that
out. Night Dive Studios did those.
I didn't really... I know you mentioned that before, but I didn't connect it for some reason. How many you got left?
So I have two left.
Okay, so I have one left. So you do one, I'll do one, then you do one more.
All right, so my number two was Pokemon Snap.
Oh, this is one that could be on somebody else's list.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's a pretty short game, pretty simple game. Like, not all 151 original Pokemon are even in it.
And you're so not a Pokemon head.
No, but I love this game.
Yeah.
I like the original run, and I really like this game. The Pokemon Stadium games were also cool. They had really awesome mini games, and there was Pokemon Puzzle League, which was like basically like a Tetris Attack pound upon game. Mm-hmm. But this is the game I always played. I mean, there's just something indescribable about this game that is just so like makes it so replayable, so fun. Like I go back to it every now and again, right? Because you could run through the game very quickly, but like the fact, like knowing what to do to make the different Pokemon appear at the different times and get the best picture, like there's something addictive about this game.
It's also just so novel.
Yeah,
like what game ever was that passive, that was that entertaining? And like and the fact, I mean, there's so few ways that game developers have found to have players interact with the world, and it usually involves at the end of a knife or a sword or a gun or Mario's feet or something aggressive, right? There's very few times when games find different ways to interact with them, and this was absolutely one. You were not affecting the environment in that way. You do to bring, you know, you're documenting it, and that's just so wonderful.
Yeah.
You know,
and it was cool that we finally got like a successor on the Switch, but yeah, I still love the original Pokemon Snap. Were you a big fan of this one?
So I played it, but I was not like a mm-hmm. like a big fan or anything.
Okay.
But I played it and I enjoyed it for sure. All right, man. So I'm going to go for this one. And I'm not saying that this game is like a masterpiece or anything, but I really enjoyed Conker's Bad Fur
Day. That was my last game.
Oh, was it?
Yep.
Awesome, dude. Let you start.
Yeah. So once again, another rare title. I feel like this is like one that probably just misses the list for me.
Yeah.
Like in terms of like where I would hold it.
Yeah.
But what a weird, wacky game. The fact that this game was made is kind of startling if you think about it, because it was sort of like taking the cutesy things that Rare and Nintendo were doing and then like turning it on its head and creating like a crass, you know, filled with like curse words and you know, poop and peeing and fart jokes and everything, you know, like going for that sort of humor with this cutesy squirrel character. And it's sort of like being like this weird, like it's not really a platformer. It's more of like just like an adventure game
with
where
guns
you're going through these like different scenarios and like having sort of this juxtaposition of like Saturday morning cartoon and like Adult Swim, you know, mashed together.
And apparently it was intended to be much more kid friendly.
Yeah.
And then it evolved because it was so similar to Banjo-Kazooie. They wanted to make it something different. So they made it, they changed what was originally going to be called 12 Tales Conker 64 into Conker's Bad Fur Day, when he's now like, you know, a mouthy adult foul mouth squirrel.
Like he's hungover and peeing on things. And,
yeah.
There was a Conker game, I think, on Game Boy Color prior to this. So, you know, which was just like, you know, a whole
straight ahead
thing.
Yeah.
Where, you know, and they took that character. And
then obviously this, one of the places this game is most notably known for is Live and Reloaded, which was the Xbox version, which where they went a lot
after
more
Microsoft acquired them.
Uncensored and rough, but.
But it lost some of that, like, cartooniness meeting this. So since everything was like high, you know, high def, not really, but you know what I mean? Like more realistic. They were like, look at Conker's fur. Look how realistic it is. It lost some of the charm, like the cartoony charm.
I don't need realistic fur at this point, especially not when the whole joke is
you
look
don't want
at that
to be
cute squirrel.
K.
Yeah, right. That's right. But think about it. Oh, wow. That was good, man. Cause that was that what they said?
That's what they said about, I think it was Crash Bandicoot. Well, like the recent remakes, 4K.
Oh, that's funny. Because, 4K. Yeah. Okay. No, that's good. That was good, man. No, that's good stuff. But no, that game is just, it's just so weird that it exists. And it's so, like, cool. And, man, boy, does Rare dominate? It's like Nintendo and Rare are the two, like, big killers on this.
And
on
you
this
think
thing.
They would have done something to preserve that partnership, but
they made
Nintendo
so many
did
mistakes,
not.
Dude. They made so many mistakes. Wow, man. Well, that was, I tell you what, I started this out by saying this is not one of my favorite consoles, and it isn't. But, man, I have a lot. I feel like this took me on a whirlwind tour of that, of the N64.
And I think those are 10 pretty worthy games that mostly hold up.
Like,
I would say the majority of those, except for maybe one or two, like, are absolutely worth playing today still.
Totally. Man, well, that was a fun tour. Enjoyed going on it with you. And I guess next up, we've got GameCube.
Yep.
That's going to be fun.
I love the GameCube.
GameCube's cool, man. The pink, the purple lunchbox. Let's go, yeah. Dude. Let's go. On that note, you can find us at The Joy of Game on Twitter. You can email us at thejoyofgamingpodcast@gmail.com. My name is Rich Lepore.
I'm Brandon Brino.
We'll see you soon.
Bye, guys.